The managing director, by tradition, always an European, always a European, always from Western Europe. It's the chairman, it's the CEO of the IMF. And in case there is a divided vote, then the chairman has the casting vote. That's casting vote too for major issues, and it also the managing director also administers the organization. The IMF articles of agreement require that the managing director be independent, accountable only to the IMF, to the organization, not to the members. Not members, right? So it represents the organization. He's the managing director should be the spirit of the organization. It represents the organization. And the first deputy managing director is always an American, always American. So and they share the power. They share the power. Most of the staff we could see that all the staff, or none of the senior staff of IMF came from developing countries. None of them. So in IMF, 60 years history, none of them. The senior staff, including the director, a few deputy director, division leaders, those senior fellows, none of them came from developing countries. The only exception will be Dr. Zhu Min. Dr. Zhu Min is now the vice governor of the People's Bank of China, the central bank here, and he will serve as the assistant to the managing director very soon. And that's the first developing country representative in the IMF as a staff. So the IMF is a very elite organization. And why Zhu Min is given such a position very much because the new managing director, Dominic Strauss-Kahn, wants to involve China more, want to give China a larger voice in exchange for Chinese cooperation for IMF activities. That's the very much the structure of the IMF power. How do the members vote? That's also a very interesting question. As I mentioned, it's not one country, one vote. Right? It's very much $1, one vote. So money talks in the IMF. Money talks in the IMF. $1, one vote. And it's not that you have money and you want to join, but you also cannot buy the shares. You cannot buy the votes. Like China nowadays has a lot of money, but China only has a very Chinese the voting power is very insignificant because the old powers are not willing to increase China's quota. And the old powers, I mean the European powers, not American. U.S. actually want to increase the Chinese voting, China's quota, and the U.S. also even asked Europe to reduce its quota, but rejected by France and the U.K. So that's the reality there. The voting power is based on your quota in the IMF. Very much like shares. In the IMF, the quota decides your subscription to the IMF reserve called special drawing rights, the SDR. It decides your voting power. It decides your access to financing. When you are in crisis, the larger quota you have, the more money you can borrow from the IMF. That's the take a look at the country share of quota here. The U.S. has 17%, right? Followed by Japan, by Germany, by U.K., by France, China, India, and Brazil. So that's how it's shared, how the power is shared. Right? But the Chinese economy is already larger than the Japanese economy, second largest economy. UK, France, they are much smaller than the Chinese economy and the Japanese economy. So that's the and India is also underrepresented. Russia is actually overrepresented, because Russia's economy does not correspond to its voting power. Does not, in terms of its economic significance, Russia does not deserve 2.73%. So Russia is overrepresented. For the emerging economies, for China, Brazil, India, that's a critical issue to decide whether they want to cooperate with the IMF. The G20 meeting will be held again very soon, just in a few days, I guess. And the foreign spokesman of the Chinese Foreign Affairs already set five conditions for Chinese cooperation at the G20 meeting. One of them is IMF reform, to IMF governance reform, to increase the quota of developing countries. Of course, China wants it to increase its own quota. This is a very ongoing debate and a very interesting story to follow. Okay, so that's the structure of the IMF and a little background. Any questions so far? Washington, the Beijing consensus. The Beijing consensus was, as a term, it was first coined by an American practitioner, Rommel. He's now the executive director of the Kissinger Foundation in the U.S. He's the people like Robert Keegan, this kind of stuff, strategic advisors to somebody, and he published a paper in U.K. Entitled Beijing Consensus, and in that paper, he said that for many decades, theoretically, the world has only one developmental model. Right? So, in order to develop, the discourse has been that in order to achieve economic development, in order to achieve better governance, you must follow the Washington Consensus. The Washington Consensus is a consensus achieved among the World Bank, the IMF, and the White House. So what is Washington Consensus? What does Washington Consensus entail? It means the liberalization in trade and investment, opening to other countries, good corporate governance, and stable exchange rates, and also sound fiscal policy, and a healthy taxation policy. It has roughly 10 requirements for the Washington Consensus. And you also have, you need to have a market economy, privatization. So the government should get its hands off the market. the little stake the government has in the market, in the economy, the more likely you can achieve economic development. But if you look at the Chinese model, it's very different. China has a huge state sector, state-controlled economy, and China is not yet a full market economy. China only followed a gradual approach to foreign trade and investment liberalization. It's very much controlled liberalization. And China, for the past 30 years, China has the highest growth, economic growth for 30 years. This is coupled with China's political system, such as you have an authoritarian government. Is that a problem? We have an authoritarian government, and have a Chinese interpretation of human rights and political rights are very different from the Western understanding of that, and still you can achieve economic success, right? And to him, to Rommel, this is a different model. This is a different model. And so what are the pillars of the Chinese model? One is first is a government, right? A very effective, very efficient government. Committed to economic growth, so economic development override everything else. The second is encouraging innovation, technological innovation. And what's the third one? I can't remember. So it's depoliticized elements. So the Chinese model does not emphasize the ideological political elements of development. It's about a neutral government committed to economic growth and encouragement of technology and innovation, and I can't remember the third element, third pillar of the Chinese model. It doesn't matter whether you are a democracy and whether you have your market is liberalized and whether you have good corporate governance or not, right? And so those elements emphasized in the Washington consensus are actually not that important. The Chinese model suggests that a neutral government and encouragement, so very much investment in technology and innovation and something else, those are more important than other factors. Right? And this might pose the threat to the long-established Washington consensus, the Western path to development. Right? Okay. Any questions so far? Any questions by from our visitors, or you want to already fall asleep? So eager to leave? No offense at all. If you have something else to, or you can even daydreaming. I don't mind. I don't even know. Sure.
Mexico votes for Latin America and Rwanda for African countries.
Yeah.
And I was looking at the country share of quota there.
Yeah.
So like Latin America in total, that represents, for example, the country, it doesn't represent Mexico, but does it represent all of the other countries that Mexico represents? I'm just trying to think how the country share of quota relates to how Mexico votes. Does the Mexico number reflect the country it votes for, or just Mexico's country share of quota?
Oh, here the Mexico, its own quotas here.
Just
its own quota. Yeah, that's in terms of quota. Latin America in total only has 7.6%. They are of course underrepresented, right? Mm-hmm. And they are under. If you their economy combined is much larger than that. Of course, especially if you count Brazil. Brazil is a very rapidly growing economy. Brazil is a very large country, right? So they are underrepresented. They are under, and the U.S. is also underrepresented. The U.S. is also underrepresented because the U.S. economy is actually larger than the U.S. share of the world economy is larger than 17%. Larger than 17%. The U.S. is also underrepresented, but for the U.S. it's not a big issue because the most of the something I should have already mentioned, for the fundamental issues, for the most important decisions, you need an 85% super majority. And now you understand the story. Right? The U.S. as a country can veto any decision because you need 85%. To pass a resolution. If the US does not agree, you can never meet the 85% threshold. Right? So the US as a country can veto any decision. So, but for the U.S., as long as the 85% threshold remains, then it's 16%, 17%, 20%, 25% doesn't make much sense to it. So for the U.S., over 15%, that's good enough. But the U.S. Believes that Europe is overrepresented. Europe is, of course, if you look at Germany, U.K., France, they don't deserve that. In terms of the importance of their economy. So the U.S. has asked it publicly that Europe reduce its, Europe transfer its shares to its quota to developing countries. China actually never asked this. China never asked any country to transfer. China made a general argument that more power should be given to developing countries, but it has never asked anybody to transfer quotas to itself. But the U.S. actually asked on behalf of China, Brazil, India, asked your European countries to transfer shares to the quotas to China and India, especially China. That's the very interesting political economy there. You can see it's not that Western countries are united here. They are not united, actually. They are not united here. So we are having a very interesting stage in international relations. Right. Please.
Do China, India, and Brazil tend to vote as a bloc as well?
No, they don't. Separate? They don't. The BRIC countries are not united. Developing countries are not united. Yeah. let me put it this way: it's very much issue based, for example, for rescuing developing countries. Countries that the U.S. sometimes is not interested in providing aid to Asian countries because it's, for example, U.S. in the initial stage of the Asian financial crisis, Asian financial crisis started in Thailand, and the U.S. actually. U.S. actually vote against IMF rescue of Thailand because the U.S. argument was that's a regional crisis. Right? Thailand economic crisis would never significantly affect the U.S. economy. Right? But China, India, because the Thailand is of course much closer to China and India, so they voted of course together. But that's issue based. Developing countries are never united. They are very fragmented. Very fragmented. They're never united. And the EU in total, EU has even a larger stake. The EU as a whole, of course, can block any decision. But the EU does not, in terms of the importance of its economy, EU does not deserve such a high share in the IMF. But the EU is also not willing to discuss this at all. The French foreign minister. This is a lady that said very vigorously that any discussion of reduction of French quota would be out of question. So that's the very interesting. The dilemma is if you do not give those developing countries a larger share, then they wouldn't support you. They wouldn't support you. They will. They have for six decades. They have been marginalized. Right. Now they are more powerful. They want to marginalize the IMF, and then you have. And if you do not include them in this, then you might create your own enemy.